Marc Dubois is a legend of the environmental movement. Born in 1949, he was raised in Sacramento and spent much of his youth exploring the canyons and the Stanislaus River. His life has been one of starting visionary organizations and movements. At the age of only 23, he started Environmental Traveling Companions, a nonprofit specializing in taking inner city and disabled adults down the Stanislaus River. He's also the co-founder of Friends of the River and International Rivers Network that have both been leaders in river conservation. The two organizations are still very much active today. Friends of the River persists in a mission to protect and restore California rivers, and the International Rivers Network that he started now spans four continents and continues a global struggle to protect rivers and the rights of communities that depend on them. In 1979, he captured national headlines when he chained himself to the bedrock of the Stanislaus River Canyon for 7 days as a new reservoir filled. It goes on. He was the international coordinator for Earth Day in 1990 and 2000. Recognizing the devastating effects of dams around the world and the promotion of dams as quote-unquote development, his work has expanded to include lobbying the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. In 1991, Marc Dubois founded Worldwise, a grassroots campaign for international bank reform, challenging the World Bank to reform and redirect their investments to fund projects with more positive and sustainable social, environmental, and economic benefits. As a visionary activist who has birthed several highly effective organizations and have been at the forefront of the environmental movement for decades, it is not just the work he does that astounds, but the way in which he does that work. On chaining himself to the canyon, he states, quote, "At some point, I knew that I was going to have to speak out with a louder voice, the only voice I had left. When I was in that canyon, it didn't matter what the outcome was. It was the most liberating sensation I've ever had. I felt very powerful. I found my voice completely, and I was speaking out for my deep truth. I was laying my life out on the line for something I believed in with all my heart." It is this spirit for the work and the work itself that is so deeply inspiring. It's a great honor to speak with Marc Dubois. Welcome, Marc. I wanted to start off with a question about the upbringing of your childhood, where your love of nature started, and a little bit of the background of, you know, your parents. Did they have a deep love of nature, or did they have a religious or spiritual background that, you know, incited your passion?
Yes, I'll just first say, again, it is such a privilege to be with all of you and the stunning work that Service Space has been doing, inviting all of us to live more deeply and live with more generosity. So I appreciate all the pioneering of the remarkable community you're growing. So I grew up in Sacramento, California, and I think my dad had bounced all around California in his growing up, so we would often go car camping to Tahoe, to relatives in Napa, to relatives in the foothills, and ultimately my parents got a little one-room cabin that we had to hike into a mile in Trinity County. So all of those weekends connected me to, and I felt much more comfortable wandering in the beauty of the wild than my awkwardness. I was tall and uncoordinated, and so it was easier to be in nature. And I, you know, there was this, it was a tonic for me, and I sensed for all of our family. So.
And then, you know, when you were at the young age of like 22 or 23, you started to combine that love of nature with, you know, this effort to bring poor and underserved kids rafting down the Stanislaus, I believe for free. Can you tell us about that, and what was that inception of combining your love of nature with almost like a beginning?
Yeah. Well, in high school, I had discovered caves, and my brother, a few weekends later, said, "Oh, I went down that river down below those caves," because the Stanislaus had the only limestone canyon on the West Coast, and it was honeycombed with caves. And as I went down with high school friends down the river, eventually I worked a couple years as a commercial river guide. And a friend had this idea of taking inner city kids down for free. And so we got donated some old boats, and we had seen the difference the river had made in people's lives. I still remember at the end of one wonderful commercial trip, and I remember we had just had this extraordinary time, and I watched, he was really old. He was probably in his late 20s. He was a young doctor. And I watched him hesitate jumping back into his brand new Porsche to go to his large San Francisco house. And I could tell it was just fascinating. I watched him hesitate, and we knew that he knew he couldn't buy what we had just shared, mm-hmm. that the richness that we had just shared, the less we had, the more we had. And so it was a fascinating experience. So when Fred had the idea of taking down inner city kids for free, it just landed deeply. And before long, we weren't just doing river trips. We realized we started doing earth trips. We would, the 9 miles of canyon, before long, we started doing, instead of 2-day trips, we were doing 5-day trips. And we were teaching about the plants and the animals and the caves and the archaeology and the history. And it just felt like it was, you know, the stars. I mean, there was not enough time to learn the beauty and the magic that was in this enchanting canyon that just broke open everyone's hearts and smiles.
That's beautiful. Was all your education informal? Were there inspirations or mentors that connected you to nature, or did it just feel like it came naturally?
I think it. I mean, again, it probably came because of the nature was a refuge for my dad, and so it became a refuge for all of us. So I sense it is more, on one level it's embarrassing thinking how, my brother and I would play cowboys and Indians, so we'd pull off all the moss off the big rock and use it for bombs and whatever. So it was not I sort of learned despite myself. You know, Mother Nature spoke beyond the disconnection that I had been raised with in a city. And so it sort of slowly kept opening and growing me. I mean, I just loved all the beautiful early comments of people's connections. And that beauty and magic, again, seemed to help transcend whatever organized training I had in a city that was so smart. and something happened out there that was well beyond and more profound and deeper than And then some of that, brilliant education I got, but there was more going on.
Got it. And then when you started to connect, the nature that you were experiencing and fell in love with this larger environmental consciousness of trying to preserve that nature, when did that kind of evolve?
Well, that the first caving trip I did, probably in 66 or 67, the leader had pointed down to the bottom of the canyon and said, "Oh, by the way, they're going to build a dam on that." And I looked down and, "Oh, that looks too bad. It looks like a beautiful canyon." But I had been raised going to dam sites and how important they were for our evolution. And so it was a slow falling in love. And I will say there was one turning point when we were taking these inner city kids out, and it looked, there had been growing amounts of campaigns, and slowly I'd try to get involved. And even if I couldn't write my grandmother, it was really hard to try to write somebody important. But I slowly engaged in some of those efforts. But it was pretty clear we kept losing. And so when we started going, well, where else would we take children? And it turns out the Tuolumne was way too exciting. The South Fork American had mostly private property, so you couldn't do the kind of exploring we had been doing. The North Coast rivers were too long of a drive to get people there. And so I found myself, that query of where to go next made me, again, deepen my knowing of how unique this place was.
Awesome. And, this, for those of us that don't know as much background of your history, when the Stanislaus River at, I think, 28 or 29, you chained yourself to the canyon as they were trying to flood it. Why was the Stanislaus River worth fighting for and worth dying for, even, that you were ready to essentially die if it meant protecting that river?
I feel like I'm still trying to understand how to put in words why that was a choiceless choice. I will say that, after taking inner city kids down, one brilliant friend who had been leading a lot of the efforts to save the river and other rivers, Jerry Merrill, said, hey, we're going to do this thing called an initiative. It worked for 1970, so in 74 we're going to try, how would you like to coordinate Sacramento? And I go, oh, sure, a couple hours a day. Well, anyone who knows rivers knows there's a place called a tongue, and it's this big, beautiful, glossy green, often, depending on the color of the water, V that takes you into the rapid. And once you enter a tongue, there's a place of no return, and the current sweeps you downstream. Well, by saying yes to Jerry, I got swept into river politics. And so I kept learning and learning about how to translate the magic of the river into and the logic of trying to save rivers from the development, because we all need progress and development. So those early deep love affair, and then more and more learning water politics and what was needed and what wasn't needed and where we were, I will say that at some point we had lost one more campaign. And we had gone up to the river to both mourn our loss and to plan the next campaign. Well, after the late night campfire, it was pretty easy to be mourning our loss, but we didn't have any idea for what to do next. And early the next morning, we're camped at this place called Razorback, the 1,000-foot cliff that rises vertically across the emerald water. And I walked upstream to this little tiny grapevine gulch that came in. And as I had my feet in this just crystal clear water, there was, water falling out of the limestone rock, and the grapevines were reaching out and the butterflies were dancing across. And in that moment, I just felt life. And in this just extraordinary feeling, I also had this awareness that if I left, if I just moved on, because we were going to lose, if I left, I would be very similar to the people in Nazi Germany who had a hint of what they were doing. Because by this time, I had learned that we didn't need the power, we didn't need the water. This was the 24th dam on the river, and this was being built out of old momentum that had been a good idea before I was born, but it was no longer a good idea. It didn't make economic sense, and I knew it didn't make sense to life.
Wow.
So, at that time I was just going to start trying to move one rock at a time, and they were dumping dump trucks as big as houses every hour. So I knew that it looked futile, but that's all I could think of doing. But anyway, at some point that turned into, okay, well, if you are going to flood 9 million years of evolution that this canyon has been evolving in, you could take one other critter instead, because my life is nothing compared to the miracle and magic that is vibrantly flowing through this place as it has for eons.
Mark and Sheree, I wanted to just add to Mark's beautiful sharing that one thing I've learned from you, Mark, too, is that you deeply engage in a relationship with nature. And, the Stanislaus, the rivers have allowed you to fall in love with the rest of the world. And it's in when you have a deep relationship and a love, there's no way you can turn your back. That's how you're knowing you, meeting you and being the recipient of one of your legendary hugs, you feel life move through you. And it's really a touching experience, and I've got great gratitude for that. So thank you.
Well, thank you for that. I do. I mean, I'll see. There is that line in me that knows. Oh, be careful what you fall in love with. At one point I had the privilege of going down the Grand Canyon with Dave Brower, and he was doing talks every other day, and as we looked at the borehole in the Grand Canyon for the dam site that he had stopped, he didn't talk about his success there. He talked about his loss, his lament for not stopping Glen Canyon. But he talked about all these important things. And the last night, the seventh talk, he said something, and I missed it. It's like everything had been so powerful, but the last talk he gave, he said, every resource I've talked about is non-renewable. The more you take of it, the earth pays for it. But there's one resource that the more you give out of it, the more it comes back to you, and that's love.
That's you.
And a friend in Moscow said it on one level a little better. I was there during the Soviet Union times, and I said, "Well, Leonid, how do we get more people involved with protecting the earth and peace between our countries?" And Leonid said, Mark, first it is important that one fall in love." And then I realized that every major change I've ever seen done by Margaret Mead's small handful of people, it happened because of people falling in love and indeed gaining a deep connection and knowing that love is not out there, but we're intertwined, we're interconnected to each other and with the sacred.
So, those of us that consider ourselves activists, like in, the Stanislaus for you, eventually they ended up flooding, right? And you ended up losing that particular struggle. And is it that deep love and that connection that allows you to recover? I mean, you've been doing this work for several decades. And for example, I think just a couple of days ago, Narendra Modi in Gujarat, they said they're going to raise the Narmada Dam by 17 meters, and there's going to be 200,000 people displaced, and they're moving forward with that. And so in the face of kind of the continuous struggles, how do you kind of maintain that optimism and kind of come back to the table again and again and again?
Well, my optimism may wane like the waves as well. A week ago, I did go up to the Stanislaus, and I spent 5 days. And it's when I floated through the death ring of this reservoir, I found myself thinking of the Toltecs who would, you know, cut out of a living being and hold up this pulsing heart, and I found myself again just feeling this just this deep cut in the sacred earth to give us a little more money and power, and we just have no connection with where these things come from, as one of our earlier speakers talked about. And so I will say I've started falling in love with that river 48 years ago, and I'm still trying to learn what that love affair has done for me. But I did get renewed when I was there, that I do not want this to happen to any other sacred place on the planet. And so, you know, I had the privilege of being with Metapakkar before Narmada Dam was built. And I remember we were back at the World Bank annual meeting, and we were lobbying, and we were at this just incredible opulent party where all these bankers, thousands of bankers, come. And I remember sitting with Maida, who I knew had been village to village to village, where these the bankers had no idea, the local states had no idea how many villages, let alone how many people lived there. And they were planning this big sign of progress for modern development. And it was so powerful to be in tears, as there was more food and drink and ice castles of art and flowers ceiling high. And I remember Maida saying, I don't know what to tell my people who have nothing, what these bankers are doing with their money. So I say that because my heart has been broken over and over again. And what I've also learned through all of this is that we are such a young and on some level immature species, and we're doing these things out of the hamster wheel of our mind, out of great intentions, and we have given more people more things. There are more of us, and our creative genius has taken us this incredible distance. And what I know is that we are now at a time when we get to tap into, we are much, 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 much more powerful than we know. And, you know, a few people have pioneered the strength of when we, you know, Anne talked about meditating and anchoring us. Well, it feels that rather than anchoring, that we when we're in nature, as one of the earlier speakers talked about, we get grounded to something much, much more profound. And we don't, in our youthfulness as a species, we don't often take the time to, we get caught in our hamster wheel of all the important busy things we're doing, and we forget to tap into the depth of our heart and our gut and the half of our brain that knows we are much, much more, and we are intertwined with all of this, all of the sacred of this miracle. And so people like, you know, Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Mother Teresa and Wangari Maathai and Mandela all tapped into this deep knowing of who we truly are and what we are truly capable of. And so for me, my optimism does come from knowing that as we awaken, when we awaken beyond blaming them, when we step into really tapping the wealth within us and that that's not within us because it's just intertwined within all of life, then we can more powerfully, as we learn to live into this beauty, power, and magic, we get to inspire others. We don't have to fight to stop the old, because this is truly the only game in town. It's you know, the beauty and magic that we all know at our core, we get to learn how to live beyond fear and scarcity and live in beauty and joy and love and invite the world to play with us.
That's really a beautiful story. And yeah, I think a lot of us kind of stand on the shoulders of so many of you that have done that work and tapped into and shown us the way of how to tap into that beauty again and again. For you, is it a practice, or is there a way that you go about doing it? Is it being in nature? Is it meditating? Is it, you know, a practice that allows you to connect back to that space within you that, you know, allows you to see that beauty in the face of, you know, so much of the destruction that a lot of mankind is persisting in doing?
Well, I wish I had a clear answer for that. A year and a half ago, I met this remarkable neighbor I hadn't met when I lived in the Northwest for a while, and she asked if I meditated, and I said, well, I don't think so, because I have this image of what meditation is. And then she outlined four different kinds of meditation. I go, oh, well, I don't meditate, but I do all of those. So it's like, what I sense is each one of us are such a unique antenna and pulsating antenna in the world. So, you know, for me, I've lived sort of my life as an apology, wishing I could be as, you know, smart as my friends Brent Blackwell or Jerry Merrill, or wishing I could be as calm and radiant as a few people in my life. And ultimately, I've slowly been relaxing into, oh, I don't have their skills. I don't have their talents. And learning to slowly honor what's my path. And paying attention to those people, those voices, those quotes that resonate with me, and paying attention to, so what's mine to bring, what's mine to give forward. And I will say, in the last 3 years of my walkabout, it has been a meditation has been paying attention to how much fear rules my micro decisions in life. And a part of me is just, I'm just amazed at these old patterns and habits, and I can intellectually know they don't serve me anymore, and I want to drop them, and I want to live more present and more loving and without fear. And yet they come back, and they come back. And it's been interesting to honor, oh, I don't know if I will ever transcend these things, and yet I am more and more just honoring who I've been and what these patterns are, and breathing into that I am all of these little things, and I am much more than all of that. So I don't know that answers the depth of your question, but I'll you know, it's like, you know, again, it's one of the early in the Q&A, someone talked again about, I mean, several people talked about again what going to nature does, and I will say that I seem to, even if my life is focused on wanting to figure out how do we make a difference now at this sacred time on our planet, I am drawn to, you know, taking a walk or taking a river trip and watching that again. It definitely roots me, grounds me, deepens me into remembering the magnitude of I am a part of all of this.
Mm. I remember the I'm a medical doctor, and I spent like 6 months in East Africa. I continue to spend a lot of time in different places, but you know, the first time I was in Burundi, we had this hospital on the top of the hill, and it's this really beautiful, beautiful location, and there's just lush mountains as far as the eye can see. But every day there was, in the hospital, there was, such destitute poverty and so much malnutrition. And in the course of a few months, I must have seen like 12 or 14 kids die of malnutrition. And I just had a lot of anger and, frustration at like how, they're just trying to connect the dots between poverty and health and, what my role is in it. And, I remember kind of being up at like 4 or 5 a.m. and in that silence of the morning and the sun rising on a mountaintop, like a lot of my like anger and questions like started to drop away in that silence. And you do feel this like kind of awe connection to so much of nature and a lot of the things that you grapple with and struggle with and questions that arise. Like I think in that stillness, somehow it makes a little bit more sense. So I can totally resonate with what you're sharing. And
that's really beautiful. It is, there's that tapping into that stillness, which is accessible to us at any time, and it does seem to come at 4 a.m. or in the quiet of nature, and yet it's accessible anywhere. And how to tap into that, and as you described your anger, I will say I am more and more clear that when I do anything out of fear and scarcity and separateness and anger, then I am more and more profoundly convinced that I'm just reinforcing the old paradigm. And it's not until as I slowly, ever so slowly, learn how to take actions out of love, whatever that looks like, feels like, then I am beginning to help co-create a truly the world that we're meant to live into.
And that's beautiful. Is that the advice you would give to, say, a young activist that may be in Narmada Dam right now trying to move against the displacement of 200,000 people and the magnitude of the struggle for a lot of people that do not, that do not have much at their disposal and are up against tremendous amount of power, is that like a lesson that you think that young activists need to take?
I'm more and more convinced it's an inside job. That for me, I have been drawn to how do we grow, deepen, and mature activism. And again, this I've known it for a long time, but it's more. I'm more powerfully, insightfully knowing that again, when I'm fighting against, then I'm actually just reinforcing. So there's something that Gandhi pioneered. British civilization. I've read all about it. I love the concept. But this is it. And if you're going to practice this, you should go home and practice it. Because it's a beautiful idea, but not here and not the way you've been practicing. And so how to honor the moguls of development, of of again, we're not here to fight you, and this is not development. This is not working. This is not progress. And so we know you, I mean, you may be benefiting tremendously from all of these big projects, but we know you're doing this because you think it's right. And to waste more energy, to waste more fuel, this is the way you want to go. And I would say is that as activists grow and deepen, it's, again, the fighting against, I think we almost always lose.
Yeah.
When we can, I mean, to, on some level, to be able to hold, you guys want to practice 19th century technology for the practice of the future? Look what's happening around the world for 21st century technology. Why waste your money in these mammoth sinkholes of hydroelectric dams when there are solutions coming up that are much cheaper, much better cost-benefit ratio, and give us the quote, the products of development without plundering the earth, which is now costing a fortune. In the U.S., it's costing a fortune to tear down these disastrous old dams as we slowly learn that natural systems had this richness and verdance to them before we got here. So how to be able to do an Aikido, how to be able to do a Gandhi with, oh, we're not here to fight you, and we are not going away. We are speaking here with all of our lives. And our love affair with the sacred, even if we're still trying to find words to put parody, I mean, it's, you know, on one level, we're talking two different languages to me, that the quote modern world is taking and converting everything sacred into dollars and cents and product. And that which our hearts know is our true wealth comes from being connected to all of our neighbors, those people you saw in Burundi, and to this sacred earth. And that's where our true wealth comes from. And we've all been seduced by more and more stuff, thinking the stuff will get us happy. And it's so
yeah.
clear. You know, Americans have so much stuff. This is
Sri and Mark, I'd love to invite our callers to join in our conversation, too. This is such a beautiful conversation. Thank you. And it's, Mark, you remind me also of, you know, our own ability, our own power to tap into the goodness into ourselves and to every being, and to really not come with judgment, but to come with a full heart. And, you know, that language of the heart, just, you know, it breaks down all barriers, and it's so powerful. So thank you.
Yes. It's so true.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have a call from, I'm going to invite Prakash to ask a question.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, Sri and Mark, I'm feeling eternally grateful for this wonderful gift of conversation. Thank you so much. What are some of the most important things that comes to you as that we can take responsibility for to continue to preserve and hold these sacred rivers in the most important place?
Well, as you can well imagine, I have full resonance with water having transformed my spirit as well. You know, that love affair with the river. I couldn't dance on a floor, but the river, I learned how to dance and to play with its powerful flows. And I learned to not fight anymore, but to dance with its magic. And I'm still trying to apply those lessons to our urban world. I think to answer your question, I'm going to share briefly an exercise from a friend, Michael Dowd. Because you say, what, you know, what can we do now? And Michael Dowd's exercise is you take a piece of paper and draw a line down the middle of it. And on the top of one side, you write, my greatest joys. And you start listing everything that you just love doing. When does time disappear? When does your heart sing? When do you, I mean, what are the things that bring your greatest joy? And just, he said, don't think about it. Just write, 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 write. And after a while, you'll slow down, be ready to keep adding to that, and then go to the other side. And on the other side, write, the world's greatest needs. And don't think about the zillions of problems there are, but what are the issues that most impact your heart? What are those issues that make you want to be in denial and or throw the newspaper away or want to punch somebody or want to cry? What are those issues that your heart's antennas are most set for? And so again, write and write and write and write. Don't think about it. Just what does your heart know for you? For you, what are the greatest, the world's greatest, you know, crises, challenges? He said that again, keep adding to that every day, those, but occasionally look at the list and find out if there's a place where my greatest joys match with the world's greatest needs. And he said maybe within a year or two, you will find your life's mission. And so I will, so to answer your question to me, each one of us get to learn to look into and learn our heart's fine-tuning. We are all so unique, and there we can learn, you know, there are so many things we can do to lessen our impact and to be more conscious. You know, every penny we spend, we are voting for the world. So I vote for the oil companies almost every day. I'm embarrassed to say that. But, you know, I can hate what the oil companies are doing, but I vote for them. And so so how do I be a more conscious consumer? And I'm also aware that every breath I take, I add more fear and scarcity in the world, or I add more love. So, you know, so I want, how do I be more conscious with every breath, with everything I spend, with everything I use? When I turn on the faucet, am I aware it's connected to some miraculous stream that has dragonflies and wildflowers? And that doesn't mean to not use water. It just means to be conscious of where things come from. So how do I become more conscious of my both impacts and what I'm putting out and what I'm taking in. But ultimately to me, the most important thing each of us can do is pay attention to what our hearts know. And so little of our culture reinforces paying attention to our own gifts. You know, again, as I say, I've spent my life being trained to think, oh, I wish I was good as others. And I'm finally knowing that I don't have others' skills, but most importantly, when I bring my greatest joys with the world's greatest needs, then I get to find, I sense that when, as more and more of us do that, and I think that is happening all around us, and as more and more of do that, the problems we face will start to vaporize, because we will be living in more integrity. And the power of our heart's knowing will start creating more solutions. We'll be connected with more people, and we'll be having more fun taking on that which needs to be, that which we get to take on now. So I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Hi, thank you so much. This has just been really beautiful and really helpful. My name is Alisa, and listening to your words has made me think about a few things. If you are operating from your heart, I think people are starving, and the world is starving for this change, what you're doing, but they don't know it. and they have to feel it from that. Otherwise, they'll be defensive. I know I get defensive, you know, if someone comes at me with something, I'm like, no. And yet it could be a good thing. But if they're coming from that pushing point, I'll put up my wall or hand. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, indeed, indeed, indeed.
Yeah.
Well,
so I search out connection with other people. Finding people is a little trickier. So how have you found more people with what you're doing or that feeling? It doesn't, because there can be people who are along the same, like in a lot of activism, I would find that I was getting, you know, okay, there's too much pushing, so I back off and I come at it through different ways.
Yeah. You know, again, this sense of the more I learn to live in my heart, the more I let go of all the fears and the scarcity, then it feels like doors open.
So, again,
I feel like one of the things that does give me optimism is what you said, is what I do know is that humanity, we are craving something and we don't know what it is. And our, quote, modern sophisticated language doesn't have as many, you know, we are not rich in language to capture this. And I think you're right, that's why service space has grown so beautifully, because it's offering a place to begin exploring the language of that which our hearts yearn for. Two quotes I am drawn to share. Let me see, one of them is when my son was getting ready to take off to India at 17, we were having a conversation, and he said, "Well, Dad, that reminds me of Robert Bly." And he then plucked it, he opened it to page 97, and he started reading this quote. And what I got out of Robert Bly's quote is he said that as you study every culture in the world throughout history, throughout cultural diversity, contemporary time, you find that every culture has this very common thread. Every culture's stories seek to connect the vast, vast distance between the head and the heart.
Mm.
So my sense is our evolutionary journey is we are all trying to learn how to make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
The other quote is from is something like this. Someday, after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love. And then, for a second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great quote.
So that's from Pierre de La Chardin. And to me, you know, one of my dearest friends keeps saying, "Mark, that's magical thinking. What are you talking about?" And I think that for you captured what it answers Sheree's earlier question of why do I have optimism? Is I have had the privilege of experience when our hearts align. You know, when I've had the privilege of aligning with the miracle of nature, and dancing with water, and all of a sudden I am not me. I am dancing with this incredible flow through time and space in the universe, as someone described falling into the night sky. And I've also had that privilege of doing that with others. We're all drawn to sort of romantic partnerships, and yet there's this other partnership that when we're all gifting our collective creativity towards really gifting the future, and yet we're not living the future. We're following our heart's instincts for what we know now, what is needed at this sacred time in our collective evolution. And so as we all, you know, part of my optimism is I feel that which you said, that craving of the human heart to know that we are much more than what we hear on television all the time and all the hamster wheel of the mind. And slowly we are paying attention to the depth of who we are and what we know and what's ours to do. And as we get our egos out of the way and pay attention to that, look out, world, here we come.
And even, you know, I think paradoxically, or maybe not so paradoxically, is that the people that are engaged in this work of service and connecting to nature are the most optimistic. You know, I think a lot of the people that I work with, they're staring suffering in the face. They're looking at extremely challenging things, but the amount of vibrancy in their step and the buoyancy in their spirit is infectious. And so I think the antidote to despair is definitely engagement in the present moment, whether that be service or meditation. And I think service space is definitely testimony to that, and Mark Dubois' life is testimony to that. So I think as you start aligning yourself along those ways, you start connecting with more and more people that actually are engaged in a meaningful way and have a lot of love and hope in their life, no matter that they're working on very difficult issues.
Mm-hmm. Sri, beautifully said. Do you know the Gandhi line? Service which is rendered without joy helps neither the servant nor the served. But all other pleasures and possessions pale into nothingness before service which is rendered in the spirit of joy.
I think we have a little more time for a question, and I wanted to invite Deepa.
Okay, thank you. This has been such an amazing conversation with everything. Mark's voice, just the vibrations coming from your voice are feeding so much. And I wanted to ask, sorry about the background noise, but if there's any way to continue tapping into this extremely rare space of connecting the deeper processes with the external activism work. I haven't found this channel anywhere else, and I'd like to keep growing from it. Thank you.
Well, I will say that for me, it is the only conversation I care about. And I've had a passion for years of how to deepen and grow and mature activism. And for me, every single person we're an activist, because we are activating the world that exists. We're activating the world that exists by everything we purchase, by every action we take, wherever we put our attention, we are activating the world. And so in this deepening and growing and maturing activism, I've been saddened to hear how few activists, you know, understand that Gandhi may have come from a much more powerful place. Because on one level, like myself, I sense I've done everything out of earnestness, and I care so much. And I've been doing it out of fear and scarcity. And it is taking me so long to understand that, you know, it's not to take away from the successes and the losses I've had, because I care. And I do sense it more. I mean, again, it's back to the attraction of service space. You know, the attraction of, you know, we are all drawn to. When I was a caver, I noticed that none of the plants were being drawn into the darkness of the cave. They were all craning their vines to reach towards the sun. And I sense that is true for all of us, that we are all craning to reach for the light. We know it when we feel it. And in our immaturity, our minds have seduced us to how powerful they are, and all of our language has trapped us there. And I am profoundly convinced that we are at the greatest transformation humanity, we're at the cusp of the greatest transformation humanity has ever been in. That yearning that Alicia talked about of the human heart, we are at a time very, very similar to before the Berlin Wall fell. We're at a time just before apartheid ended. We're at a time just before the Vietnam War ended. We're at a time just before the first environmental movement, when 20 million people showed up to speak for the earth. The week or the month beforehand, the powers that be looked as locked in as ever before, and it looked like they were unstoppable. And then within a week or two or three, the consensus for the old paradigm crumbled because it just didn't make any sense anymore. And we dropped it. And so the craving that, you know, each of us pay attention to the power of our hearts, we're at that same cusp. And we get to engage those conversations of, are we doing this out of fear or are we doing it out of love? Well, I'll share one last quick story of Running Rivers. There's a class one to a class six. Class one is flat water, canoeable. Class six is unrunnable. You die. If you run a class six, you're dead. So class five is right on the edge. If you run a class five, you can drown very easily. So to run a class five, you have to be really good at paying attention to where everything is. You have to learn to see all the horrific big things that can eat your boat, shred your boat, and everyone in it. You have to look at all the small things that if you're not paying attention, they will push you into those big things. And what makes it a class five is you have to see there's a through line, and you have to put all of your attention into the through line. Because if you focus on the obstacles, they become magnets and you get drawn to them. So I am convinced that humanity is at a time where most of us want to be in denial that we're in a class five. Those who are looking are putting all their attention focusing on the obstacles, and we need to be paying attention to all the obstacles. And we're now getting to mature to where's the through line. And once we find the through line, we get to put all of our collective attention on that together. But we need everybody's insight because others can see things we can't see. So there are no them. We are all in the same boat together. And we get to use each other's seeing and put all of our attention to a through line and co-create a future that all of our 70 generations from now will be going, oh, They did good. They got us on the right path.
Well, Mark, you may be speaking to this already, but I have one final question for you, and that is, how can we as Service Space support you on your journey?
I think you're already doing it. By being on your journey, you're already doing it. and maybe by asking, answering the last speaker's, you know, question, it's to me continuing to engage in this question of what supports all of us in this deepening, paying attention to our hearts and learning to play together the corollary is facing the most challenging the threats that, you know, threaten the future. And one of the challenges for me as Service Space is people are so drawn to this, and can Service Space also apply this incredible wisdom that's coming out of your community and help focus on or help individuals turn into groups focusing on the resonance that each of us know is ours to do, and create communities around what are our challenges now and how do we get to play together to resolve them and solve them.
Thank you. And I'm going to invite Sri to join me in a closing, and I just want to thank you, Mark, from the bottom of all of our hearts for this, you know, for your time and generosity and sharing, you know, sharing your journey so really, you know, so transparently, you know, all the difficult places, the challenges, but also where your heart aligns. And, you know, you're sharing, to me, I think of our paths as a path of remembering. And we, when we are in nature or we're in that quiet space of silence, we remember. And I think we carry the wisdom within us. We all have the wisdom. And it's allowing it to unfold. And as you said, pay attention to that pulsating antenna. So thank you. And Sri, if you, I don't know if you'd like to say a few words of gratitude.
This has been an amazing conversation. I think, you know, I think at the last service-based retreat, there was this discussion about the wisdom of elders. And even though Mark is not that elder, he's that spirit of combining activism and also this giftism, Gandhian spiritual wisdom. You know, I think for all of us in, you know, the generation below, and even, you know, children, like, it gives a permission to follow in those footsteps of people that are really walking the walk and living a life of commitment, engaged activism and wisdom. And I think it's just incredibly special and amazing to hear from people like you. And so I'm definitely grateful to have had a chance to talk to you, and even just looking, you know, up all the work that you've done to ask some questions this morning. Just the more I read about your work and the organizations that you've spawned, it just made me so inspired and exuberant about being a participant in the same journey that you're on in a different way. So thank you.
Well, I definitely don't feel an elder at all. I feel like we are all in this same boat together. And I'm also reminded of that Bucky Fuller line that your children are born somewhat your elder because they're born into a more mature world.
Beautiful.
Be aware that we're all elders together, and especially as we pay attention to our hearts, we get to intergenerationally, we can co-create something far more beautiful than, anyway, we're all of us, yeah, and you said it, that as we pay attention to that, our own antennas, we're in the midst of this incredible, opportune time in our collective evolution, and we all get to, we don't have to, we get to step into what our hearts know at this time, and I'm so privileged to be playing with all of you and so moved at, again, what your community is co-creating and gifting the world for giftism, for good news, for paying attention to the quiet and beauty.
And I wanted to also thank all the callers who called in the beautiful questions and the deepening of the conversation. It really felt like we were in a circle with around a fire, and there was a beautiful talking stick, and everyone just shared so deeply and with such presence. So much gratitude for the entire call this morning. So thank you. And I'm going to unmute everyone so we can all say thank you to Mark.
So thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. It's a wonderful call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Yum, yum, yum.